Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today has a gambling background, but his accomplishments have far exceeded the gambling world. Blair Hall was a blackjack player in the 1970s and basically helped to invent the big player betting technique made famous by Ken Houston. After blackjack, he's been very successful as a financial investor and has been active in Democratic politics. Blair Hall, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
All right. Let's start with blackjack. How did you get started?
Well, my brother-in-law in about 1969 or 1970 said that he went to Lake Tahoe and he would earn enough money to pay for his vacation while playing there. Now, he was an accountant, and I said, okay. I said, but if that were true, then you wouldn't be an accountant because you would have increased your bets significantly during that time and you wouldn't have to go to your job as an accountant. And so I took the game very seriously and at that time and became a studied everything I could, read, called Julian Braun, traded him commodity tapes for a new strategy and took it very seriously.
Now, wow, yeah, that took some initiative to actually get a hold of Julian Braun.
Yes, well, I think any book I read, I'd call the author, make sure that if I had any questions, that was the best source, was to call the author.
All right, clearly he has not read Million Dollar Video Poker yet. All right, but I digress. You played with a legendary Al Francesco, who now is known to be Frank Schiappone. How did you join up with him, and what was that like?
Well, Frank really was the innovator of that, of the big player strategy. It wasn't Ken Houston, and it wasn't Blair Hall. So, you know, all the credit, as far as I know, should go to Frank Schiappone. He was the godfather. He was a great mentor, and I owe an awful lot to my work with Frank. It's ironic that there was a gentleman by the name of Jerry Johnson that I had worked with in statistics. I had done some work in operations research and management science, and I had a colleague that worked, I think, for an insurance company, Jerry Johnson, who knew some statistical programming, and he had met Frank on an airplane, and Frank had told him about this strategy. And I actually tried, in hearing about this, I tried to implement this, but it's very difficult to implement, especially nowadays. We know more about it. It would be easier now, but at that time it wasn't. And unfortunately, my friend Jerry Johnson died in an automobile accident, and so I had lost my contact with Frank Schiappone. It's sort of ironic, but it was surprisingly that Frank Schiappone had kept my phone number, and 1 year later he called me, and I had the chance to meet with him in an attempt to qualify for the team, which, of course, you know, had various tests associated with it.
Did you pass?
You must have passed, right, because you didn't get on the team.
Actually, I did not pass the first time. I had to switch counting systems. I think I was using the basic plus minus in Thorpe's, and I went to the Revere Advanced Point Count, and I did not pass the test the first time, but I jumped on a plane to use that count in Las Vegas for a weekend to make sure that the next time I went back through, I could pass it. So it was But Frank was ingenious about the times, the qualifications required and the various exams that we had to pass in order to qualify for the team.
And were you still on the team when Ken Houston got recruited, or had you already left?
No. Ken Houston was on the team when I joined. But as I recall, and Frank can clarify this, I think I was promoted to be a big player before Ken Houston was.
Aha. Uh-huh.
There were some strange things about Ken Houston, as we know. And I was deemed, I think, to be a little more logical, sound,
sober.
And so as a result, I was promoted. And one of my great regrets is that Ken and I did a lot of the mathematical analysis of Gambler's Ruin, and to make sure that we came up with the betting strategy, how much would we bet in certain true counts. And so I was close to Ken, and I actually lobbied to make him the next big player. And that's one of my great regrets, because Ken was not he was the least person, the last person you'd want on your team, Ken Houston was.
Okay, I actually don't want to follow up and have us trash Ken's memory, but we'll leave it at that for now.
No, we don't need to do that. No, don't need to.
Were there life lessons you learned from gambling that you think helped you become successful in business investing?
Well, I often say that, the only thing you need to do is get an advantage, get an edge, and stay in the game. And blackjack taught me how to stay in the game, how to control my emotions and play by the rules that would allow me to optimally get my optimal return on investment. So I think that in addition, the teamwork of collaborating with others, following a schedule, being in the right place at the right time with the right skills and the right preparation are all things that would serve one well in life and serve me extremely well. So without playing blackjack, I'd be driving a cab today, or probably more accurately, I'd be an Uber driver.
Well, but now wait, you were, prior to that, you were a math teacher, right? Or
Oh, I did. Yeah, that is true. I did teach high school algebra and physics, and I did have a reasonable job at a corporation working in quantitative analysis. But I still think my entrepreneurial efforts would not have been successful without my blackjack experience.
Well, actually, a number of former blackjack players are currently Uber drivers. So go figure.
I'm considering it right now. It's great. I love the greatest innovation in transportation in 50 years.
You know, the one I'm actually looking forward to is the driverless cars. I mean, and actually Uber too. I'm sure I've heard that the vast their biggest expense is the drivers. So once we have driverless cars, I can't wait for that day.
No, it's going to happen. No question. No question about
now,
it. And a lot of the work we're doing right now in financial analysis and the project that I have now is dealing with machine learning and predictive analytics. And so we'll get on to that
okay.
later.
Yeah, we are going to talk about the project you're on now. Calling it very loosely, for now, a hedge fund or a similar organization, and you can tell us why that's maybe not a good word later, but you need to have competent employees. Would somebody who either is or who previously has been a successful professional gambler, other things equal, would that be a desirable employee or an undesirable employee?
Well, my experience was that with people the discipline to be a successful gambler is a high level of discipline that's required. And I'd certainly never shy away from hiring somebody that had been a professional gambler. So, no, I say it's a desirable. If you've been successful And there are a few of us out there, but it would be a desirable characteristic. Absolutely.
Well, and it does seem that do you feel very much in the mold of Ed Thorpe, who also was extremely successful coming from gambling? And do you guys kind of walk the same road?
Oh, I very much admire Ed Thorpe. I've seen him a few times in the last few years, and he is. I'm honored to be following in his path, to be able to at least do part of what he has done. No, he's my hero.
Mine too.
A financial advisor friend of mine who works in Las Vegas said that he would not want to hire a professional gambler because he would be afraid that that employee would come to work basically hungover from working too many hours at the tables when this employee found a good promotion that he just couldn't resist.
Yeah, no, but I agree with Blair in that, you know, if you were successful as a professional gambler, you had to have discipline. So, you know, I wouldn't be worried about that kind of thing.
All right. Now, usually our show avoids talking about politics unless it directly relates to gambling. At the same time, we've never had a guest before who has run for the United States Senate. In 2004, you competed in the Illinois Democratic primary for the U.S. Senate, ultimately losing to a guy with a very unusual name of Barack Hussein Obama. Although I'll never know from personal experience, I would suspect that competing in a Senate campaign would be a life-changing experience. Was that true for you?
Well, it certainly is an experience, and all experiences are part of our education. When you get through with that experience, and it doesn't occur over a short period of time, because you need to know people throughout the state, and Illinois is a large state, so you travel the state up and down 102 counties, and as a result, you really do broaden your perspective. You see that the world is composed of numerous problems, and it's, of course, it's your job to try to attack the address those issues. So I would say for sure it's an educational experience, and in life you don't seldom do you regret what you did. It's more what you didn't do, and I'm glad that I did run for the United States Senate.
Is that something you would ever do again?
No, Richard, but I'll support you.
You couldn't pay me enough to get involved in that mess.
To some extent, I dodged a bullet.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right.
There are a few. I wish we had more qualified people that would step up. I think we do need representatives that are come from normal walks of life.
Now, you've had a number of very successful funds of various sorts, and they require investors. Frequently, people with a lot of money to invest in funds vote Republican. And you are an outspoken advocate for more liberal causes. Assuming one of your goals is to attract as many investors as you can, it seems to me that quietly supporting the causes you believe in would make more sense than publicly supporting causes that potential clients would be opposed to. What am I missing?
I think people are more concerned. Voters who are also investors are more concerned with their return on investment than they are necessarily what side of the aisle you're on. And my positions, although socially responsible, have been quite moderate. And so I don't think investors are really going to be concerned. You have to realize the majority of my life has been I have been a proprietary trader. It's only been recently, very recently, that we've gone into and launched a publicly traded fund. So it is, most of my life has been dealt as a proprietary trader where I did not have investors.
So how did that happen? How did you, one day you're playing blackjack with Frank, and then you woke up one day and said, I think I'll go become a trader. I mean, how did that happen?
Well, first of all, the team, we did get barred pretty severely. And although I did start another operation that I called the Big Six, we had six players, two big players, and each player had two counters. And we were successful in the later 70s after the big team broke up. And although I kept doing that, I did, you know, I was into dealing with probabilities, and I tried to take a look at stock prices and associate probabilities with those stock prices. And if you take the expected value of the probability distribution associated with the stock price, it ends up to be an option value, the value of an option, and that really converges to the Black-Scholes model. So to some extent, I had created the Black-Scholes model and was trading options as a customer when I went over to the Pacific Stock Exchange and found out that, whoa, if you're going to do this kind of trading, you ought to be down on the floor, and that's what led me to the Pacific Stock Exchange to be an options trader.
And, I mean, the other thing is, obviously, it's a much bigger casino than the casinos are. You know, the upside is so much bigger than what you could ever do in casinos.
Yes, and I think there is some social benefit to the fact that you are providing liquidity to investors. Investors that are buying things as a result of you being in there and trading, they're going to get prices that are lower when they buy things, and when they sell them, they're going to get prices that are higher because you are participating in that marketplace. So I did feel that there was a resulting social value from dealing with investments more so than in the gaming industry.
And at some point then you started doing quantitative analysis to do your trading?
We got to realize that I did have a bachelor's degree in mathematics and an MBA in quantitative finance. So, and I worked at Kaiser Cement and Gypsum doing computer programming and implementing strategies that would help business, such as optimally transporting cement from plants to distribution facilities and such kinds of problems. So I was well prepared to not only program the Black-Scholes formula or my original formula, which then was a derivation of the Black-Scholes model, but to implement strategies that would use technologies to its fullest. And although I remember going down to the Pacific Stock Exchange floor, and I said, oh, my God, I saw all the paper and the way they transacted business, and I said, I can write a computer program to make this place obsolete. This place is going to go away within a year. Well, we know now that almost all exchanges are automated. My direction, my vision of where things were going was exactly correct. My timing was off by about 30 years, but... So I was well prepared to take on that task.
Hey, about the Black-Scholes model, some of our listeners may not know that the official Black-Scholes model led to a Nobel Prize in 1997 for the two people who published it. But one of those Nobel laureates, Robert Merton, later ran a firm called Long Term Capital Management, which collapsed spectacularly, while the companies you've run have done exceptionally well. So either you weren't using the same model or you were not, or something. Do you have any explanation? So if you're using basically the same model, why his collapsed and yours didn't?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, the Black-Scholes model was called the Black-Scholes-Merton model at one time. And Robert Merton I very much respect him. He did get involved in long-term capital management, and as happened a number of times in even though we think about that, and I can't remember when that debacle occurred, in the late 90s, maybe a couple years after his Nobel Prize, we've seen that a number of people have underestimated risk. And Robert Merton was one of those, along with Myron Scholes, was also involved in long-term capital management. So as we saw in the 2008 debacle with mortgages, that we thought we could combine these mortgages, and we didn't know there was a systemic event that would cause them all to default at the same time, long-term capital management made the assumption that all these interest rate products were highly correlated and there couldn't be a disconnect to the extent that there was. And so when you got too many people chasing the same arbitrage, and when suddenly it went, it started to go against them, they all got out at the same time and caused long-term capital management, which was leveraged to a larger extent than it should have been, to collapse. So it's those things do happen. I think that I've been fortunate to have avoided those debacles. I think I mentioned a little bit earlier, you call your program the edge. This is that you need, that's only the first requirement to being a successful gambler, is getting the edge. Staying in the game is extremely important. And if you don't have the right betting strategy, even though you have an advantage, you can be almost guaranteed to lose all your money with the wrong betting strategy. So the betting strategy relative to the edge is what Robert Merton failed to recognize, and that's why gaming and gambling is so important and understanding those concepts as you enter the investment world.
One of your claims to fame is in the big crash in the late 80s, when everybody else was going broke, you apparently were able to find the bottom and go in and start buying. How did that happen?
Well, that's sort of interesting. That's called being in the right place at the right time. And in that case, I followed a principle that I've had while being a trader on the floor, and that was that in an option pit or a futures pit, brokers will come in and they will get quotes on prices all the time. And I was one of a few people, only a few people that used this strategy. Basically, it was no matter what the guy asks you for, you give him a response. Where will you sell 1,000 contracts? You tell him where you'll sell them. You may give him a ridiculous price. And so that's what happened, is they came in. It was actually Drexel Burnham that later went broke, came in with a sell order 3 minutes after the Chicago Mercantile had closed in the major market index, and said, where will you buy 100? And I gave him a ridiculous price, and he said, you own them. And I had a large lump in my throat thinking, oh, my God, what have I done? And and actually, it gets worse than that, because about an hour before, when we heard rumors that the Chicago Mercantile was going to close, I told the firm to be long on the halt. When we halted trading, we wanted to be long, because that was the culmination of fear. And it's possible, that, as I explained with Robert Merton, actually underestimating risk, that it just happened that I hit the bottom. It was, but it was more right place, right time, with a little courage.
Now, you know, I just recently read a really interesting book called The Quants. Maybe you're familiar with it. but in it, they talk about how in the early 2000s, Ed Thorpe kind of saw all these quants entering the market, and he thought that there were just too many players for everyone to still be able to make money, and he kind of shut down his fund. Did that affect you, all those quants entering the market and the amount of trading they were doing?
Well, you got to realize that my sale to Goldman Sachs occurred in September of 1999, and I was with Goldman for only for another year. So I was not in the trading business at that time. In fact, I was from 2000 to 2005. That Senate race was in March of 2004, so I was involved, wasn't involved at that time. So I don't think that's a bad. I don't think that was a bad decision. Nor does I don't think Ed Thorpe regrets it. And of course, there was. I think it, maybe it was 2007. There was a too many people having the same strategy. Another problem similar to long-term capital management that occurred with all the quants at that time. It's a very tough game these days as a quantitative investor. We have an abundant supply of very talented people using a variety of tools that we didn't have, which is analogous to the car, the automated car now. We have all those engineers that are building automated cars that then take their skills at night over into financial markets.
How did you do when that the big downturn hit in 2007 and 8?
Well, 2007, 2008, that sort of leads into a strategy relative to the market, the market timing in the market. We had a traditional portfolio exposure, and so I didn't do well either. I did adjust at the bottom to make sure I had adequate equity exposure at the bottom. So I did poorly, but probably it was okay relative to the rest of the field. But I was determined to get a systematic and disciplined way to approach the problem of equity exposure and market timing. And I have been fascinated with the subject of market timing even since the 70s and early 80s. And even though, and I did a little study at that time and concluded that although there was potential to time the market, the returns that I would get by doing so would not be as great as those within for playing blackjack or options. And so as a result, I concentrated for the next 18 years in buying undervalued and selling overvalued securities. But I returned to that market timing quest. And in 2012, developed a model that has led to the product that we have today.
Now, that is, you have an exchange-traded fund, right? Which, full disclosure, I actually own some of, which I think I just got in January. But can you tell us what is the idea behind the fund? What's your strategy, the market strategy of that fund?
The fund has two assets. It has cash and it has spiders. And what we say is that there are tools now, predictive analytic tools, that can now tell you what the equity risk premium is going to be. And that is, how much do you get paid to assume equity risk? And so as a result, this fund will either have a large proportion of spiders or a small proportion. So it can actually be 200% long and be as much as 100% short.
For our listeners who don't know what a spider is, would you just explain that?
It's an exchange-traded fund that holds 500 stocks in proportion to those in the S&P 500, which is the most actively traded and most followed equity index. So it's a representation of what stocks are worth at this time.
So basically then the fund either is betting on the S&P 500 to go up or betting on it to go down.
That's correct. And it may be recently it is said that it's not betting either way. It's pretty neutral at this point in time, saying that there isn't a great deal of reason to believe that we should be bullish or bearish at this time. And this has changed over the life of the fund. Last year, in June, we were something like 80% long. And through the summer, the model that we use And there is a paper that will be published on this and is available in the Social Science Research Network called A Practitioner's Defense of Return Predictability that anybody can download. We're very transparent about this process because it's very difficult to do, but we're telling people of the approach we're taking.
Now, I saw I think it was a Barron's article from last September, and at that point you were very bearish. You were betting pretty heavily against the S&P. But now it's changed and you're more neutral?
No, actually, I think that might have been a Forbes article.
You're right. I think you're right.
I think it was a Forbes article, but what it said is that we got out of the market at the appropriate time, before the market dropped in August. And I think that's what they were talking about. We may have been short, just slightly short, but it's right now the model, I believe the long-term model says 12% short, which I say is about neutral.
And the other 88% in cash?
Well, if in the case of a 12% short position, what we do is we have it all in cash, but then we've actually borrowed securities and we sold a certain amount of securities against it. So we actually have 112% cash in the month. Unfortunately, we're not getting great interest rates these days. So we have borrowed spiders and then sold those short.
Are you interested in more investors? And if so, how do people find out about that?
Well, this is an exchange-traded fund that has a symbol HTUS for Hull Tactical United States. And they can look at that on the web, and they can go to any brokerage firm and purchase it. So that's this is available to the public as an open exchange-traded fund.
And as you said, on your website, you basically sort of give all the details of what it is you're doing, right? It's almost like open source.
On the website, hullinvest.com, we give the basis of the model, including we actually show you where to get the data and explain how to replicate the paper that we've written, which is called A Practitioner's Defense of Return Predictability.
You know, you also you had a really interesting quote, and that was that for 30 years people said that predicting the market was trying to predict the market was irresponsible, and in the next 30 years people will be saying to not predict the market will be considered irresponsible.
Well, that comes from I'll actually go back to your mention of Robert Merton, who won the Nobel Prize in 1997. He, in about 1985, he said, it's a fool's errand to try to estimate the equity risk premium, how much you're going to get paid for equity risk. And that has that shift. There's been a shift in the academic literature since his statement at that time. This stigma of market timing, which is it permeates the investment world, I believe will go away as we see sophisticated techniques actually predict the market. We have this explosion of data that has occurred since 2000. The government is reporting data that they never did. We have not only the internet, but Twitter and social media now gives us certain insights into things. And the predictive analytics and machine learning that are driving cars are now capable of driving portfolios. And my comment was that just as it was considered irresponsible to time the market in the last 30 years, I believe, I'm not exactly sure we've got it right, but that somebody's going to get it right and that it's going to be considered irresponsible in the next 30 years not to participate in market timing.
Let me play devil's advocate briefly, and I'm very hesitant to go up against somebody with your repute, but if we all have models which do market timing and we're all interested in buying and selling from the same pool of stocks and options and commodities, won't that make the swings much, much bigger as we all come to the same conclusions? I would think that if you can do it, and I can't, which is certainly the last part is true, assuming the first part is true as well, then that gives you a competitive advantage. But if everybody can do it, then that seems to give nobody a competitive advantage. What am I missing?
Well, well, there are a couple things in what you've talked about. First of all, the market always becomes more efficient. People do pick up techniques, and so there's no question about that. In terms of the volatility in the marketplace, this kind of strategy does have a value component. So as prices go up, we tend, if you watch our model at all, we do tend to be a slight seller. We'll tend to be shorter as if prices go up and market goes down. We'll tend to be slightly longer. There's a small component. There's a definite, a distinctive value component in our model. So that contrarian spirit helps reduce volatility in the marketplace. But the stigma of market timing is permeates our society to such an extent that it's not going to change a lot very quickly. And that's one of the reasons we're quite transparent about what we're doing. I don't believe that that's going to change very easily.
So even though you believe everybody should go that way, you don't think you're going to convince that many other people. Is that what you just said?
Yes, that's correct. That's correct. I don't believe so. And I think, you know, it's hard unless you have this kind of a model. There are two things you need. We talked about this before. You need an advantage, and you need to stay in the game. Well, you need to stick to the plan. This has got to be a very disciplined, a scientific and a disciplined, systematic process to beat the market. And it is not easy to do. We've got four people working on this full time. We have the luxury of having a proprietary trading firm that's got 30 people with extremely good quantitative skills, and we've got the infrastructure and data to be able to gather the data in a very timely manner. Without those resources, I'd have to say that market timing would be foolish. But I believe that just as we are have been successful in taking advantage of this data and this technique, more firms will do the same in the future.
Well, certainly if it works, people are going to jump on, right? I mean, everything is like that. Do you think 100 years from now that the markets will all become so efficient that people won't be able to make money off them?
Well, there is a return for assuming risk. So certainly there will be an equity return, and those returns will fluctuate as they always have. I think that things are becoming more efficient every single day, and they have been since I entered the markets. When we started, I played blackjack heavily in 75 and 76, and I became a market maker on the Pacific Stock Exchange in early 1977, and from the first day I entered, walked on the floor, to the second day it became more efficient, and the third day, and every single day I'm involved in the markets, they become more efficient and more difficult to get an advantage. So, that's not going to end.
You know, it seems like many of the exact same skills and infrastructure that you have are the things that people apply to beat sports betting and horse racing. Does that ever tempt you to go out and try to beat one of those?
Well, actually, I did it back in the 70s, though, looking for ways to get an edge. I had a model that did professional football, I've always had an interest in that. Also, I was involved with Frank Schiaponi and helped him key punch, I don't know how many thousands of races that went into a book that was written, Tom Ainsley, was it, that had got used to. So some of my data went into some of those books that were written, that were written about horse racing. And of course, we know Bill Benter's tremendous success in the field. So there's no question. In fact, I have some associates that are trying to make a run at Bill right now and he's got another very strong competitor also, as I'm sure you know. Those games are they're not a lot different than the options in the futures and the equity games that I'm playing. They're pretty similar.
Right, right. That's why I thought maybe you would be tempted to jump in, but no.
No, I have been, but it's hard to be in three places at once, and one is lucky to be able to develop skills to beat one of them.
So we've been talking about similarities and differences between gambling and investing. When you make a specific trade, can you say how much is investing and how much is gambling or speculating?
Well, we're talking about the definition of investing and the definition of gambling. And William Sharpe, who was the Nobel Prize winner from Stanford in the 60s, defined an investment as a sacrifice of current consumption for expected future gain. You don't spend the money today, but you expect to get more interest or real estate or some return on it in a mathematical expected sense. A gamble, therefore, would be a sacrifice of current consumption for expected future loss. So when I make what portion is investing, what portion is gambling, I'm hoping that I have a positive expected value on all my investments. You know, some of them don't work out, but in the long run, hopefully I have justification to believe that the odds are in my favor.
Well, I have that same approach when I gamble as well, although some of that doesn't work out so well either.
So I would consider you an investor when you are what other people would say gambling, because you have worked out, you have a positive expected value, and
yes.
And you're playing according to that. You're betting in proportion to your advantage, in proportion to your capital. You're using the Kelly criteria, and you're going to, in the long run, have more wealth than you do today.
So
the problem is, how long is the long run? Is it 1 year or 10 years?
Yeah, there's been a bit of discussion about that, and certainly no consensus. So I think what you just said is intelligent gambling and intelligent investing are significantly identical. Is that a fair conclusion?
I believe there is no difference. I concur with you that there would be no difference.
We've been talking to Blair Hall, former blackjack player and extremely successful trader. South Point has more than 10,000 gains, returning more than 99%. This is more than anybody else has. The big promotion in May is the $500,000 spin, swipe, spin, and win. Play $300 coin in Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, and you spin the virtual wheel. Low-end prizes are 2,500 points, which is worth $7.50. Mystery gifts. And Lux Buffet's highest gifts are $25 and $50 free play. Next double point day is Monday, May 30th, midnight to midnight, no limits for those so inclined. Penny slots earn 10 times points that day, and other reels earn 5 times points. They're having an email promotion this month where if they have your email address and you play a certain amount, you receive a bonus. As an example of two of their tiers, if your normal mailer is $20 a week on Friday, Saturday, or Sunday, you play $400 and you get $40 in free play. If your normal mailer is $75 a week, you play $750 coin in and you get back $150 in free play. It's too late to get the rewards this month if you haven't already given them your email address, but they do this a couple times a year. As bribes go to get you to give up your email address, this one is pretty good. They have free senior slot tournaments on Thursdays where more than $5,000 in free play is given away weekly. At the Palm, from now until the end of May, they have drawings every Saturday night at 7:15. You do not need to be present to win, but you do need to claim your prize by midnight or it evaporates. Play for prizes Monday through Friday from now until May 27th. You earn Costco gift cards. Cards are redeemed at a rate of 0.2% up to $190 a day. You keep the point. In May, every Sunday, you earn double points on video poker and 10 times points on reels and video reels. You do not earn gift cards for this play, but double points is worth an extra 0.25% in free play, and the gift cards are awarded at a rate of 0.20%. For those of you somewhat mathematically challenged, if you play $50,000 of coin in on Monday through Friday, you would end up getting a $100 gift card. If you played on Sunday, you would get $125 in free play. The casino has recently been purchased by Red Rock Resort, which used to be called Station Casinos. According to the Palms, business as usual there until they turn over the keys late this year. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get corrections on most of the games. Often we talk about the weekly contest they have. They also have monthly contests. This month they have 5-play or 10-play dream cards. The dream card is a 10-coin per line game where periodically you get a dream card, which is the card that would be the best given the other four cards. Since it's free to enter and high scores win, it seems silly to play 5-play when 10-play is available. It has a lot in common with bringing a knife to a gunfight. All right. We've been talking to our guest, Blair Hall. Richard, did you have one other question for him?
I did. I just had one more question. That is, do you ever go out and play blackjack anymore?
Oh, my gosh. I didn't play much, although I did back, I think I backed Keith Taft in some kind of an operation in, as I recall, in New Jersey in the very early 80s. But I had not played until about 2009. And I went to Jackpot, Nevada with some buddies playing golf and was able to get my high up. I went with whatever the high op, it was 3 through 6 is plus 1 and 10 is minus 1 with a side count of aces, and was able to get the strategy off there and practice my counting, you know, taking two cards out of a deck and counting the deck, making sure I could count. And but because you get a little foggy after the, you know, 20 years of doing this, but I was able to, over about an hour and a half, remember enough of the numbers and the strategy, and I always had flashcards that would tell me the numbers, and then to be able to play. I've actually played three times there, and I played once in Las Vegas too. I have been a winner three out of four of my trips. I've been playing a lot. I played single deck and two deck mostly. The games are not. It's still a tough game. It's become a much more tougher game. But I think it's fun. It just takes me that hour and a half to after a year to dust off the cobwebs. That's
sure.
If it only takes you an hour and a half, you have an exceptional memory.
I was playing to win. I remember. I couldn't remember some of the soft numbers. I had to stop playing, go upstairs and remember them, and then come back down.
We talk about the blackjack ball every year. You've been known to show up there every now and then. Do you enjoy that?
Oh, it's great. I enjoy the camaraderie of some old friends, and I think it's a great. Max does a great job with that, and I think it's quite enjoyable.
All right. Thank you, Blair Hall. Richard, how can our guests get our old shows?
Well, first of all, we welcome your questions. You can send them to us at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com or facebook.com/gamblingwithanedge. Or you can tweet them at me at RWM21. You can get the show delivered to you automatically every week at iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, or at my site, richardmunchkin.com. And for an archive of all of the old shows, every episode ever done, you can find that at bobdancer.com.
Very good. Thank you, Richard. Thank you very, very much, Blair Hall. Go out and hit royal flushes, everybody. Good day.